This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, everyone. My name's Minnie, and I'm very excited that I get to interview my PhD supervisor, Professor Ray Norris. So, hi, Ray.
Hi.
Did you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I got my PhD here in Manchester at Jodrell Bank many years ago, only Bronze Age. Well, I'm told maybe it's the Jurassic. But anyway,
were there really dinosaurs when you did your PhD, Ray?
So I was a postdoc here for a while. And then I moved to Australia, and I was involved in building the Australia Telescope Compact Array, which has been a fantastic workhorse over the last 20 years or so.
The best telescope in the world, really.
It's got some contenders like Merlin, actually. E. Merlin. And right now, the thing that really excites me, I think probably the most exciting thing I've done in my entire career is coming out towards the end of my career, and that's the Australian SKA Pathfinder Telescope, which is a brand new telescope that we're building in Western Australia.
How much are they paying you, Ray? I see you're also wearing an ASCAP t-shirt.
Yes, I'll hold my shirt next to the mic so you can see it. But it really is very exciting. I mean, in the entire history of radio astronomy, with all the radio telescopes in the world, we've just discovered about 2.5 million radio sources, right? That's all our knowledge of the radio sky is about 2.5 million radio sources. With my project EMU on the ASCAP telescope, we're going to increase that to 70 million. So in one experiment, I say one experiment, it takes a couple of years, but with this one project, we're increasing our knowledge of the radio sky by a factor of about 30. You know, so that is actually pretty cool. You know, I don't know what we're going to discover. You know we're going to discover all sorts of new things. It always happens. As soon as you observe the sky in a new way, you know you discover new things. You know, is it going to be pulsars, quasars, dark energy? Well, no, it's none of those things. We already know about those. But there'll be, we know almost suddenly there's going to be something else that we discover and we can't guess what it is.
Ray Norris, explorer of the unknown.
Yeah.
So can you back up a second for us, Ray? Sure. Tell us where you work. You're in Australia.
Yeah, so I moved to Australia and I joined CSIRO, which is the...
Note to our listeners, Ray has made a point of not telling us when he moved to Australia.
Yeah, I'm not
there may have still been dinosaurs back then.
That's right. So CSIRO is the government research organisation.
Right, CSIRO.
There's not an exact UK equivalent, really.
Okay.
And then just recently, earlier this year, I left half-time. I've moved to a university in Western
Sydney. If I understand correctly, you attempted to retire but failed.
I'm not very good at this stuff, I'm afraid. So I ended up working half-time at CSIRO and half-time at Western Sydney University.
Good job. So now you have twice as much work.
That's right. Yeah. So my work in both places is to get EMU going.
Right, EMU. Yeah. So that's what we were talking about before I interrupted you, and that's what you're giving your colloquium on today?
That's right, yeah. So EMU stands for Evolutionary Map of the Universe.
That's an excellent name.
It is, rather. And it gets known from several places. So EMU is an Aboriginal constellation, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute.
Oh, really?
So named after this main Aboriginal constellation, that's our logo. Evolutionary Map of the Universe. So that's what we're doing. We're mapping the universe in a way that lets us see the evolution of radio sources.
So how many more? You said before 30 million? 70 million radio sources. And right now we only know 2.5 million radio
sources. That's
right.
Yep. Wow. Yep. So it's pretty exciting. And the idea is that, you know, we in our puny human lifetimes can only get a snapshot of the universe. We can't see things changing with time. We don't live long enough. So how can we figure out how the universe changes with time? And what we want to do in EMU is we take snapshots of these 70 million galaxies. It's a bit like DNA sequencing. You then try to figure out what order, because you've seen them in all these different stages of evolution, and you try to put them together in a sequence. There's actually going to be lots of different sequences, and try to see how galaxies evolved from the earliest stage of the Big Bang. That doesn't make sense. From the Big Bang through to the present day.
So that sounds terribly exciting, but I feel a little like you're yanking my chain here, Ray.
Mm-hmm.
I did my PhD with you, and something I remember very clearly is with radio continuum observing, we can't get a distance measure. So how are you going to map the evolutionary sequence of these radio sources?
That's what people used to think in the olden days, like when you did your PhD so long ago.
Dang it.
So but you're right. One of our challenges is, we're looking at all these different radio sources. We know they're different periods of time in the evolution of the universe. We need to know their redshift. In other words,
their
distance, and also how far back in time we're looking. So something 10 billion light years away, it's taken 10 billion years for the light or radio waves to reach us.
Right.
And so we actually seeing it 10 billion years ago in time, so just 3.8 billion years after the Big Bang. So we really are looking back in time. And yes, you're right. The challenge is, how do we measure that redshift? So optical astronomers do it by measuring a spectrum,
right,
seeing how the light is shifted, and they can measure it. It's much harder in the radio. And I think a few years ago we were saying, oh, it's really hard. A mate of mine, Jim Condon, made this famous statement, there's nothing so useless as a radio source. by which I mean, if you've just got this blob of radio emission and that's it, it really doesn't tell you very much. So you really want to dig in.
It's why people call it blobology.
That's right. We don't do, well, we try not to do blobology. So, for example, if you observe over a wider frequency range,
right,
you find there is information there. And we're developing techniques to measure radio redshifts of sources.
How? Using the spectral shape?
Yes, the SED.
So but radio SEDs tend to be very... It's a power law, isn't it?
You've got. I need to show you my plot. I can't do this on the radio. My talk, I'll show you. But yeah, if you've only got narrow bandwidth, you see... it's a well-known fact that if you join the two points that you've measured, that almost suddenly fits a straight line, right?
Well, of course.
Okay. Even with 3 points, maybe. But if you go right out in frequency, you look at the low frequencies with telescopes like LOFAR and the MWA, then you see the spectrum turning over.
Right.
If you go to high frequencies, like 20 gigahertz, then you see the spectrum falling off, the electrons running out of energy. Now, actually, high frequency observations are really hard to do. But a fair fraction of the EMU sources we will be able to see with the low frequency telescopes. So we will see that characteristic turnover. And that gives us some idea of the redshift. Now, we're not going to measure it to four decimal places like the optical people do.
Okay.
But we actually don't need to do that. For what we want to do, what we really want to do, is take the radio sources and put them into bins. We don't need to know exactly how far away the source is or exactly how old it is. What we want to know is this source in the last 5 billion light years? Or is it in the next 5 billion or the 5 billion after that? So for cosmology, we have many science scholars. One of them is cosmology. And we found that if we can take all our radio sources and measure... cross-correlation functions. I'm trying to think a non-technical way of saying cross-correlation functions. But we measure the structure of the shape of the distribution of the radio sources.
So you're getting a low-resolution age of the source.
Exactly.
Is that how you measure your age, Raymond?
I have to use low-resolution.
10 plus or minus an order of magnitude.
I've run out of decimal places otherwise. that's right. So if we can put all our radio sources into a few bins, for example, it turns out the cosmological tests we can do with EMU turn out to be really powerful. But it depends on getting just a rough redshift, but doing
so
it
like,
well.
So is that what they call statistical redshift?
Yeah, that's right.
That's fantastic. That's so exciting.
Yeah, and so we'll be able to measure with EMU if all that works out. And of course, always in science there's question marks. You don't really know whether things are going to work out like you think. But if it all works out, we hope to be able to detect, for example, yes, we'll see dark energy and things like everything
really?
Else.
Dark energy?
Yeah.
We should come back to that.
Right. And but more interestingly, not that dark energy is not interesting, it's just that's not actually the thing that EMU is best at. What EMU is going to be best at is measuring two things. Firstly, deviations from general relativity. So does our knowledge of gravity, does it really work over large scales?
Right.
And you might say, well, that's fine. That's dotting I's, crossing C's. No, it's much more than that. What? Because some, for example, brain world models from string theory predict that our universe is a brain, like a membrane.
Right.
And there are other universes. And that gravity leaks between these brains. And if that's right, then over large distances, you should see deviations of gravity from the inverse square law that we measure on smaller distances. And EMU, we can actually detect that.
Really?
So
how?
It's buried in statistical things. I'll give you an example. So there's several techniques we use. One of them, if I've got a low redshift galaxy, a thing like the Andromeda Nebula, something really
Andromeda
nearby.
Galaxy,
Andromeda
I think.
Galaxy, right, yeah. And we're looking at the EMU sources, which are a long way away at high redshift on the whole, behind it. And the gravitational field from Andromeda does two things, because you get gravitational lensing.
Right.
So it does two things to the background sources. Firstly, it makes them a bit brighter.
Right. So if we're boosting that emission.
Yep. How many sources we see per square degree. We'll see an increase between nearby galaxies. But it also pushes them further apart. So we get fewer sources per square degree. And the gravitational lensing distorts space pushes them apart. And so you've got these two effects working in opposite directions. And it's like subtracting two very large numbers.
Right.
And the difference is very sensitive to what goes into those numbers. And that depends on general relativity. Now, actually, Andromeda is really local. Andromeda would be useless. It's too close. But you go to a galaxy a bit further away.
Right.
But nearby, relatively nearby, within a billion light years or so. And and a few billion light years, and they really have a big effect on the galaxies behind that we detect the EMU. So all we need to do for this test, we just need to take our EMU sources and put them in two bins. We don't want the nearby ones, we'll just throw those away. So we say, okay, let's get all our EMU sources. Anything below, let's say, a redshift of 1, we discard. Anything above a redshift of 1, we keep.
Right.
And then we go to an optical survey like the Sloan or SkyMapper or Taipan. Take the nearby, they're our nearby sample, and you don't actually have to look at how these background sources move. You actually do a cross-correlation between the near ground and the foreground.
Okay.
And our simulations that we've done on this effect show that we're actually going to be really sensitive to deviations from general relativity on large scales. That's
so why are the radio sources better than using the deep optical,
because
like
we go
the SDS field?
Yeah, we go much deeper than that. So optical surveys on the whole don't go very deep, except on very small areas.
Right, so like the Hubble deep fields or the ultra deep fields.
Yes, exactly. Those really deep fields go very deep,
okay,
over very small areas. So,
but radio isn't limited, so you can see right out to the edge of the universe.
That's right. So the average galaxy in EMU will have a redshift of about 1.5.
Really?
Whereas that's okay. Even that's an average galaxy, and that's already getting to the
edge
of
the universe. So that's well over half the age of the universe.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
That's really neat.
Another thing we can detect, same sort of technique, is the noise that is in inflation. So we know the universe started a big bang, and
right,
it suddenly, we think, it suddenly blew up with inflation, and that at the end of inflation it wasn't perfectly flat, it had little bits of noise in, and that noise is actually what leads to the structure we see in the universe today. And the question is that noise just ordinary Gaussian noise, sort of thing you hear on the phone, you know, or is there some structure to it? So if for example, supposing the early universe had cosmic strings, which is a type of singularity, that actually shows up in a pattern in the noise, and it turns out we're actually very sensitive to measuring that noise as well.
Really?
Again, doing these cross correlations and things like that, and that's called the non-Gaussianity test, and we think we're going to be able to have a really good stab at that as well.
That's fantastic. So the title of your colloquium, it was...
I don't know. Do you know? I don't remember.
I've got it written
down. It is something like WTF... ??
The colloquium today is titled WTF? Extracting the science from EMU.
Right.
I was a little concerned. Right. It seemed a little bit risque to swear in the title of your colloquium.
WTF are three perfectly normal letters in the English language.
I must have misunderstood. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about WTF?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things in EMU, I said right at the beginning that in EMU, like many science projects, of course, we've got a number of science goals. I just talked about a couple of them, measuring non-Gaussianity and so on. We're going to see how galaxies evolve and things. And we understand how to do that. And we think we're going to make important steps forward. And that's how a lot of astronomy is. It's incremental steps, valuable steps. But you also know that when you do a big survey like EMU, often you stumble across things you didn't expect to find at all. And history shows, yeah, pulsars, quasars, dark energy, and so on. So what is the pulsars, quasars, dark energy that we find in EMU? Well, we don't know, obviously. How are we going to find them? That's interesting. So you look at something like how pulsars were discovered. So Jocelyn Bell was a student at Cambridge. And you know, she's looking through her data and she found these bits of scruff.
Little
so
green men, right?
Yeah. So, but you look at the things that went together to make that great discovery. So, and she discovered pulsars.
And didn't win the Nobel Prize.
Her supervisor got the Nobel Prize.
That does not
sound
fair.
The supervisor of several brilliant students. I think this is an excellent idea. When they make great discoveries, I should get the Nobel Prize. That seems fair to me. Anyway, so she was persistent, she was bright, she knew her instruments, and she's very familiar with the data. Right? So can we do this with our scan? Well, with EMU? And I think the answer is no, actually. The trouble is we have something like 70 petabytes a year of data coming off ASCAP.
That's a lot of MP3s.
So if we recorded the data from ASCAP onto Blu-ray discs,
right,
the pile of Blu-ray discs each day, we put them all in a pile, that pile of discs would be 62 kilometres high.
Wow.
From one day's observations. Right, so students aren't going to be going through the data, right?
Well, not if you like your students.
Right. So how are the Jocelyn Bells of this world going to find the discoveries in the data? And it's hard. You just can't sift through the data. There's too much of it. What you can do with the data, we've got very good tools for asking very direct questions like, how do we measure non-Gaussianity? And we do these statistical tests, you know. We know how to do that. What we don't know how to do is, how do you discover the unexpected stuff? And that, I think, is one of the big challenges facing astronomy right now. Because do you know that if you look at what telescopes actually do, most of the big discoveries are actually unexpected. If you look at the discoveries from Hubble, so there's National Geographic a few years ago got a panel to rank the 10 top discoveries from Hubble. So, right. You know, they've got discovered dark energy, stuff like that. And you rank these top 10 discoveries. Then you ask, how many of those discoveries were part of the justification for building Hubble and launching it? Right. Billions of dollars. How many did they plan to make? The answer's one.
Out of the 10.
Yeah. So 90% of the discoveries of Hubble were completely unplanned. So if you build a telescope and all you do is discover the things you were planning to discover, you've actually only got 10% of the potential discoveries of that telescope.
So WTF is an acronym.
Yeah. So what we do when we're looking for these discoveries, we're looking for outliers, things that aren't like the things we expect to see, the statistical outliers. So WTF stands for Wide Field Outlier Finder. If you thought it stood for anything else, what did you think it stood for, by the way?
Nothing at all. I had no preconceptions. Oh,
right.
Boy.
Okay. We'll leave the list.
Wasn't I your PhD student when you came up with WTF? I remember sitting in your office shaking my head saying, Raymond, that is a terrible acronym.
Actually, it's one of my better acronyms, I think. It's funny, you think it doesn't. It's a bit of fun, right? And you think it doesn't actually matter. So we, Amazon Books, they're also one of the biggest providers of web services and cloud computing.
Right.
So Amazon Web Services very kindly gave us a grant to develop the WTF project.
Right.
And they gave us a grant of disk space and CPU cycles and so on. And so, which is really nice of them. We've used it to good effect. What really amused me was there's some magazine had an article about our project, about right. WTF. And they got picked up by somebody in Amazon. And there's this lovely stream of tweets on Twitter of executives in Amazon saying, "Why am I involved in a project called WTF?" You know, so on. And just having a name like that, it catches people's attention, actually. So
I understand that. I study spiral dragons.
Right. So names are important.
What's in a name? That's really neat. So you said that WTF's one of your better acronyms. To be perfectly honest, I quite like EMU. But if I understand correctly, ASCAP, and just for the record, I think ASCAP is a very odd acronym. It sounds a little odd.
Right, okay. But, by the way, EMU wasn't entirely mine. It's also Jim Condon. I forget exact process, but I know that...
I think you sent out an email. This is like way back in 2010 or so. I was a PhD student. And you sent out an email saying, well, we're going to be doing this amazing project. What are we going to call it? So what happened there? Do you want to just tell us that story?
You probably remember better than I do, I think.
I remember you sent out the email.
Yeah.
And I remember walking to into your office and you being really excited that Jim had sent you EMU. And
yeah, but he had silly words for it, I think. He said, because he knew about my interest in Aboriginal astronomy.
Right.
And he said, why don't you give it an Aboriginal sort of thing like EMU? A great idea, Jim. Obviously, that's what we should be doing. And I forget the words he suggested, but I didn't know that good. And I think I filled in the words.
Sorry, Jim.
Even for the universe. Yeah, no, it's good. This is how collaboration
And
work.
If I understand correctly, almost all the ASCAP Pathfinder projects are named after Australian animals.
Well, a fair number of them are. So
did that all start? I think it all started after EMU.
I think we probably started the ball rolling. And then
Don't
ask me what Wallaby. So Wallaby is the other big project on ASCAP, but don't ask me what Wallaby stands for.
So Wallaby is the H1 project to EMU's continuum.
Yep, that's right. So EMU and Wallaby are the two key projects that are really driving ASCAP.
Right.
And they're sort of partner projects. We're doing the continuum and Wallaby are looking at the hydrogen galaxies.
Right.
And then there's a number of smaller projects. There's POSSUM, which is the polarization project.
Right.
The original suggestion for that was Armpit. I just thought it was the worst acronym ever.
I think that's fantastic.
And I was part of that project. I'm not going to be part of a project called Armpit.
Raymond, you're so superficial. What's in a name?
Well, a project by any other name may not get funded. Anyway, so Brian Gainsler was giving this talk about armpits.
I remember that. Everybody referred to Brian Gainsler's armpit.
That's right. And I was sitting in the front row. I have no idea what Brian Gainsler was talking about because I was working on acronyms. And so it got some questions at the end. And I said, what about possum instead of armpit?
Polarization, rotation measures.
Something sources. Yeah, I don't
know. Because armpit was, I think, ASCAP rotation measure, something.
Polarization. Right,
yeah. And I think there's also Dingo.
Dingo, yep. And that's looking for neutral hydrogen very far away in the universe. It's a very deep neutral hydrogen.
How does
survey.
That compare with Wallaby?
Goes deeper than Wallaby in a smaller area.
Okay. Yep. Wallabies go deeper than... No, dingoes go deeper than wallabies.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Got it.
And I'm probably missing some of the... I think the other projects don't have Australian animals.
Well, obviously nobody remembers them then. Actually, I was just...
And of course you have the Taipan spectroscopy survey as well.
Oh yeah, that's the complementary optical survey. survey. Yes, that's right, yeah. So, yeah, no, recently, as you know, Bjørn Emond's put in a proposal that he titled Koalas, which makes me quite happy. So, Aussie, Aussie, Aussie. Oh, we're taking over today. Right. So, you had a lot of acronyms there, and I think you also had a whiskey-related acronym earlier on in your career. Are we not allowed to talk about that?
Probably better not. We had a project called Lagavulin. Are we allowed to talk about commercial products? Anyway, it's called Lagavulin, and which is a very nice malt whiskey. And that was a joint Australian-US project to look at the links between starvation.
What did Lagavulin stand for?
I don't remember. low luminosity active galaxies using VLBI something something something. But then somebody, one of our team, Charlene Heisler, objected to it. She was teetotal and thought it was wrong, and we renamed it Cola.
Wow.
Compact objects and low power AGM.
That's a lot more I suppose that's more age friendly.
Right.
How interesting. So the other thing I wanted to ask you was that you said with EMU you can measure the dark energy content of the universe. I mean, that's what, like 75% of the universe?
Yeah.
How? We know nothing. I know nothing about dark energy. I mean, just to briefly sum up what the known, the visible universe or the known universe, the mass that we see is like from 4%, and then dark matter is, I don't recall.
I forget the numbers offhand, but yeah, it's something like that. So what we're doing in EMU, we're looking at these galaxies with black holes in, right? So a lot of the science of EMU is understanding how the black hole interacts with the galaxy. But things like this, the cosmology, they're just using the galaxies as test particles. And these test particles are spread throughout the universe, going right back to the early days of the universe. And so we know that the universe, in the absence of any other forces, these things on average are going to be uniformly scattered throughout the universe. And so what we actually do is we use these to measure the shape of the universe. So any deviations from uniformity we know isn't going to be due, you know, to God putting more black holes over here than over here. We know that's going to be a distortion due to the universe. So we're using effects like that. So
you're assuming it's smooth and even to begin with. Is that a fair assumption?
Right. Yep, that's right.
Okay,
yep.
That's interesting.
And so, and going from there to the actual numbers, I'm afraid it's just maths. I described the cosmic magnification by a nearby galaxy. That's the sort of thing. I'll give you another one if you like. There's a thing called the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which is where you get a supercluster and photons from the Big Bang coming through the supercluster get accelerated and then decelerated as they come out again because of the gravity of the supercluster. And in a flat universe, that completely cancels. If you've got dark energy, then as the photon is going through the cluster, the cluster is expanding and accelerating, and that gives you a net increase in energy of the photon.
Wow.
And so to measure that, we cross-correlate the microwave background from Planck with our galaxies, and that tells us about the dark energy of the universe. And we can actually measure, in principle, we can measure how that changes with time over the life of the universe.
That's very neat. So I would like to go back to something else you said right at the beginning. You said that the EMU is an Aboriginal constellation. So if I understand correctly, you're one of the world experts on Australian Aboriginal astronomy.
I think the real world experts are the Aboriginal people themselves.
My bad. But did you want to tell us a little bit? Recently, I think on a previous podcast, we talked about Maori astronomy. So would you like to tell us a bit about Australian Aboriginal astronomy?
Yeah. So it's been really interesting. The last 10 years, I've been studying Aboriginal astronomy as a sort of sideline.
How did you get into that?
Really, I think I was curiosity driven. When I lived in England, I was very interested in megaliths, you know, Stonehenge and things, Bronze Age astronomy in Britain. And so I think the curiosity just carried over when I moved to Australia. I didn't realise how far it would take me. What I mean by that is that, 10 years ago, I started studying Aboriginal astronomy. People had written bits and pieces in the literature, and that was all good stuff. And I wondered, how deep did it go? You know, we knew there were Aboriginal stories about the sky. That's fine. That's good. Lovely stories. Did Aboriginal people really do astronomy in the sense of trying to understand the sky? Did they try to use the sky, the motion of the sun and the moon, to predict eclipses or measure seasons?
So
like
I suppose
that.
What you're doing here is you're defining what is astronomy in its most basic sense.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I thought, it'll take a year to answer that question. And 10 years later, I now realise we've hardly scratched the surface. And so the answer is, firstly, that astronomy is incredibly important in Aboriginal cultures. And that's, I don't think anybody appreciates how widespread, how deep it goes in many Aboriginal cultures.
It's one of the oldest professions, right?
Right, yeah.
So actually, I think when I was a summer student, or maybe just after I started my PhD, you took me on a bushwalk to Ku'ungi National Park, and you showed me all of those beautiful rock engravings that were very old, or we weren't sure how they were dated, or
not sure how old they are. So yeah, I mean, one of those is the emu, in fact, which is there's this beautiful engraving of an emu, which we think is a picture of the emu in the sky. I say we think, I mean, it actually lines up in the sky with the
We'll try and get emu. A picture of that on our website.
Okay, so, that'd be really good, yeah. And we found that people explained eclipses, they explained how the tides work, had all these descriptions of how the world works based on their astronomy. They use it for navigation.
Can you give us an idea? So the Australian Aboriginals came to Australia 50,000 years
ago. Maybe more, but yeah.
Okay,
Wow. That's right. And we don't know when they started doing astronomy. It's interesting because they're almost untouched by other cultures. So we know that 200 years ago when the British invaded Australia, that they were doing astronomy, right? 200 years ago.
Right.
How far back does it go? We don't actually know. And that's one of our holy grails. How far back does it go? Certainly goes back a fair way. It's possible, if they've been doing it for a long time, their astronomy may well predate Stonehenge and so on.
Wow.
They may be the world's first astronomers, but we can't say that for sure.
And I know you've taken me to see some putative stone circles in Victoria.
Not putative.
They were stone, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so sometimes gets called Aboriginal Stonehenge, which isn't quite right because, well, first of all, it's not an imitation of something else. It's its own thing. But it is a stone circle about 50 metres across, which is actually quite clearly aligned on the setting points of the sun at the solstices and the equinoxes. So the guys who built this, the Wathaurong people, clearly knew about the position of the sun. Actually, there's an interesting local connection with Macclesfield, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the people who built that stone circle, the Wathaurong people... William Buckley was a convict from Macclesfield who escaped in Melbourne, I forget the date, it's like 10 or 20 years after the British arrived. And he spent 30 years living with the Wathaurong people.
Wow.
When he eventually turned himself in, so to speak, to the British again, he'd actually completely lost his English. He now spoke Wathaurong.
Really? Wow.
And so he almost certainly participated in ceremonies at the stone circle at Wurdi Youang.
Right.
And the bugger didn't write about it.
He
about lots of things. He actually talks a bit about astronomy. He talks about their names, the Magellanic Clouds and things like this.
Wow.
But he doesn't mention Wurdi Youang.
He wasn't allowed to. Maybe there were...
Possibly,
rules against
he lived there 30 years. My guess is he would have been initiated.
Right, no, but maybe he wasn't allowed to tell non-initiated people.
That's quite possible. Yes, you could well be right.
So unfortunately, we've actually run out of time, which is a shame because I'd love to hear more about Aboriginal astronomy. And I know you've written a book. I've got a signed copy at home. And we'll also link it, hopefully, to the website. And if you have any more questions for Ray, do write in, let us know, and we'll make sure to ask Ray anything you'd like to know about Aboriginal astronomy.
Yeah,
so thank you so very much for this, Ray.
It's my pleasure. It's great fun. Thank you.